because he has my daughter. He took her through there, and they said if we moved to follow her, they would kill her.
Magnus did not have an instant to reflect on what Valentine might do to a helpless downworlder child. He lifted a hand and blasted from his feet the stocky shadow hunter at the single door at the far end of the room, and then Magnus ran toward the door. He heard the cries behind him of the White Lords demanding, "Bane, where are you?" and a shout, Magnus thought, from Stephen, saying, "He's going after Valentine! Kill him!" Behind the door, Magnus heard a low, awful sound. He pushed the door open. On the other side of the door was a small, ordinary room, the size of a bedroom, though there was no bed, only two people and a single chair. There was a tall man with a fall of white blonde hair wearing Shadow Hunter black. He was stooped over a girl who looked about 12. She was fastened to the chair with silver cord and was making a terrible low sound, a cross between a whine and a moan. Her eyes were shining. Magnus thought for a moment, the moonlight turning them into mirrors. His mistake lasted for the briefest of instants. Then Valentine moved slightly and the gleam of the girl's eyes resolved in Magnus's vision. The gleam was not her eyes. The moonlight shine was silver coins pressed to the girl's eyes, tiny wisps of smoke escaping from beneath the bright discs as the tiny sounds escaped from between her lips. She was trying to suppress the sound of her pain because she was so scared of what Valentine would do to her next. "Where did your brother go?" demanded Valentine, and the girl's sobbing continued, but she said nothing. Magnus felt for a moment as if he had become a storm, black curling clouds, the slam of thunder and slash of lightning, and all the storm wanted was to leap at Valentine's throat. Magnus's magic lashed out almost of its own volition, leapt from both hands. It looked like lightning, burning so blue that it was almost white. It knocked Valentine off his feet and into a wall. Valentine hit the wall so hard that a crack rang out, and he slid to the floor. That one act also used up far too much of Magnus's power, but he could not think of that now. He ran over to the girl's chair and wrenched the chain off her, then touched her face with painful gentleness. She was crying now, more freely, shuddering and sobbing beneath his hands.
"Hush, hush. Your brother sent me. I'm a warlock, you're safe," he murmured and clasped the back of her neck.
The coins were hurting her, they had to come off. But would removing them do more damage? Magnus could heal, but it had never been his specialty as it was Katarina's, and he had not had to heal werewolves often. They were so resilient. He could only hope she would be resilient now. He lifted the coins as gently as he could and threw them against the wall. It was too late. It had been too late before he'd ever entered the room. She was blind. Her lips parted. She said, "Is my brother safe?"
"As safe as can be, sweetheart," said Magnus. "I'll take you to him."
No sooner had he said the word "him" than he felt the cold blade sink into his back and his mouth fill with hot blood.
"Oh, will you?" asked Valentine's voice in his ear.
The blade slid free, hurting as much on the way out as it had on the way in. Magnus gritted his teeth and gripped the back of the chair harder, kept himself arched over and protecting the child, and turned his head to face Valentine. The white-haired man looked older than the other leaders, but Magnus was not sure if he was actually older, or if cold purpose simply made his face seem carved from marble. Magnus wanted to smash it. Valentine's hand moved, and Magnus only just managed to catch Valentine's wrist before he found Valentine's blade in his heart. Magnus concentrated and made the clasp of his hand burn, blue electricity circling his fingers. He made the contact burn as the touch of silver had burned the girl, and he grinned as he heard Valentine's hiss of pain. Valentine did not ask his name as the others had, did not treat Magnus as that much of a person. Valentine simply stared at Magnus with cold eyes, the same way anyone might stare at a loathsome animal in their path and impeding their progress.
"You are interfering in my business, warlock."
Magnus spat blood into his face.
"You are torturing a child in my city, Shadow Hunter."
Valentine used his free hand to deal Magnus a blow that sent Magnus staggering back. Valentine wheeled and followed him, and Magnus thought, good, it meant that he was moving away from the girl. She was blind, but she was a werewolf, smell and sound as important to her as sight. She could run and find her way back to her family.
"I thought we were playing a game where we said what the other person was and what we were doing," Magnus told him. "Did I get it wrong? Can I guess again? Are you breaking your own sacred laws, asshole?"
He glanced at the girl, hoping she would run, but she seemed frozen to the spot with terror. Magnus did not dare call out to her in case it attracted Valentine's attention. Magnus lifted a hand, sketching a spell in the air, but Valentine saw the spell coming and dodged it. He leapt into the air and then bounded off the wall, Nephilim swift, to lunge at Magnus. He scythed Magnus's legs out from under him, and when Magnus landed, Valentine kicked him brutally hard. He drew a sword and brought it down. Magnus rolled so that it caught him a glancing blow along the ribs, cutting through shirt and skin, but not hitting vital organs, not this time. Magnus dearly hoped he was not going to die here, in this cold warehouse, far from anyone he loved. He tried to rise from the floor, but it was slippery with his own blood, and the scraps of magic he had were not enough to heal or fight, let alone both. Marion Whitelaw stood in front of him, her blades drawn and new runes shining on her arms. Her hair shone silver in his blurred vision. Valentine swung his sword and cut her almost in half. Magnus gasped, salvation lost as quickly as it had been found, then turned his head toward the sound of more footsteps on the stone. He was a fool to have hoped for another rescue. He saw one of Valentine's circle standing in the doorway with his eyes fixed on the werewolf girl.
"Valentine!" Lucian Greymark shouted.
He ran for the girl, and Magnus tensed, coiled himself for a leap, and then froze as he saw Lucian pick the girl up and wheel on his master.
"How could you do this? She's a child!"
"No, Lucian. She's a monster in the shape of a child." Lucian was holding the girl, his hand in her hair, soothing and stroking. Magnus was starting to think he might have really misjudged Lucian Greymark. Valentine's face was as white as bone. He resembled a statue more than ever. Valentine said slowly, "Did you not promise me unconditional obedience? Tell me, what use have I for a second in command who undermines me like this?"
"Valentine, I love you, and I share your grief," said Lucian. "I know you're a good man. I know if you stop and think, you will see that this is madness."
When Valentine took a step toward him, Lucian took a step back. He curved his hand protectively over the werewolf girl's head as she clung to him with her small legs locked around his waist, and his other hand wavered as if he might go for his weapon.
"Very well," Valentine said gently at last.
"Have it your way." He stood aside to let Lucian Greymark pass through the door and out into the corridor, and back into the room where the werewolves had thought they might be safe. He let Lucian bring the werewolf's daughter back to them, and followed him at a distance. Magnus did not trust Valentine for an instant. He would not believe the girl was safe until she was in her mother's arms. Lucian Greymark had bought Magnus enough time to gather up his magic. Magnus concentrated, felt his skin knit even as his power drained away. He pulled himself up from the floor and ran after them. The fight in the room they had left was quieter because there were so many dead. Someone had managed to turn the lights back on. There was a wolf lying dead on the ground, transforming inch by inch into a pale young man. Another young man lay dead beside him, one of the circle, and in death they did not look so different. Many of the shadow hunters in Valentine's circle were still standing. None of the Whitelaws were. Maris Lightwood had her face in her hands. Some of the others were visibly shaken. Now the shadows and the frenzy of battle had receded, and they were left in the light to look at what they had done.
"Valentine," Maris said, her voice imploring as her leader approached.
"Valentine, what have we done? The Whitelaws are dead."
"Valentine."
They all looked to Valentine as he approached, clustered up to him like frightened children rather than adults. Valentine must have got hold of them very young, Magnus thought, but he found himself unable to care if they were brainwashed or deluded, not after what they had done. It seemed like there was no pity left in him.
"You have done nothing but try to uphold the law," said Valentine. "You know that all traitors to our kind must pay one day. If they had chosen to step aside, to trust us, their fellow children of the angel, all would have been well."
"What about the clave?" said the curly-haired man, a note of challenge in his voice.
"Michael," murmured Maris's husband.
"What of them, Wayland?" Valentine asked, his voice sharp.
"The Whitelaws died because of rogue werewolves. It is the truth. And we will tell the Claves so." The only one of Valentine's circle not desperately listening was Lucian Greymark. He made his way to the werewolf woman and placed the little girl into her arms. Magnus heard the woman's indrawn breath as she saw her daughter's eyes. He heard her begin to cry softly. Lucian stood beside the mother and daughter, looking deeply distressed, then crossed the floor with a suddenly determined tread.
"Let's go, Valentine," he said. "All this with the White Claws was a terrible accident. We can't have our circle suffering for it. We should go, now. These creatures aren't worth your time, not any of them. These werewolves are just strays who broke off from their pack. You and I will go hunting in the werewolf encampment where the real threat lies tonight. We'll bring down the pack leader, together."
Together, but tomorrow night. "Come back to the house tonight?" Valentine asked in a low voice. "Jocelyn has something to tell you." Lucian clasped Valentine's arm, clearly relieved.
"Of course, anything for Jocelyn. Anything for either of you. You know that."
"My friend," said Valentine, "I do." Valentine clasped Lucian's arm in return, but Magnus saw the look Valentine gave Lucian. There was love in that look, but hate as well, and the hate was winning. It was as clear as a silvery shark's fin in the dark waters of Valentine's black eyes. There was death in those eyes. Magnus was not surprised. He'd seen many monsters who could love, but only a few who had let that love change them, who'd been able to alchemize love for one person into kindness for many. He remembered Valentine's face as the circle's leader had cut Marion Whitelaw into bloody halves, and Magnus wondered what it would be like living with someone like Valentine, wondered what it was like for his wife, who Marion had described as lovely. You could share your bed with a monster, lay your head on the same pillow next to a head filled with murder and madness. Magnus had done it himself. But love, that blind, did not last. One day you lifted your head from the pillow and saw you were living in a nightmare. Lucian Greymark might be the only one of the lot worth bothering with, and Magnus would bet he was as good as dead. Magnus had been so terribly wrong to let the past deceive him. He'd been wrong to think that the one with depths of goodness in him was Stephen Herondale. Magnus looked at Stephen, at his beautiful face and his weak mouth. Magnus had a sudden impulse to tell the Shadow Hunter that Magnus knew and loved his ancestor, that Tessa would be so disappointed in him. But he did not want Valentine's Circle to remember or go after Tessa. Magnus said nothing. Stephen Herondale had chosen his side, and Magnus had chosen his. Valentine's Circle withdrew from the warehouse, marching like a little army. Magnus ran to where old Adam Whitelaw lay in a pool of blood, his shining axe lying dull and still in the same dark pool.
"Marion?"
Adam asked. Magnus went to his knees in the pool, hands searching to find and close the worst of the wounds. There were so many. Too many. Magnus looked at Adam's eyes, where the light was going out, and knew Adam read the answer on his face before Magnus could think to lie to him.
"My brother?"
Adam asked.
The children.
Magnus looked around the room at the dead. When he looked back, Adam Whitelaw had turned his face away and set his mouth so that he would not betray either pain or grief. Magnus used all the magic he had left to ease the man's pain, and in the end, Adam lifted a hand and stilled Magnus's, rested his head against Magnus's arm.
"Enough, warlock,"
he said, his voice rasping.
I would not live if I could."
He coughed a wet, terrible sound and shut his eyes. "Awe atque wale, Shadow Hunter," Magnus whispered.
"Your angel would be proud."
Adam Whitelaw did not seem to hear. It was only a very short time later that the last of the Whitelaws died in Magnus's arms. The Clave believed that the Whitelaws had been killed by rogue werewolves, and nothing Magnus said made any difference. He'd not expected them to believe him. He hardly knew why he spoke out, except that the Nephilim so clearly preferred that he be silent. Magnus waited for the Circle to return. The Circle did not come to New York again, but Magnus did see them one more time. He saw them at the uprising. Not long after the night in the warehouse, Lucian Greymark disappeared as if he had died, and Magnus assumed he had. Then a year later, Magnus had word of Lucian again. Ragnar Fell told Magnus there was a werewolf who had once been a Shadow Hunter, and that he was spreading word that the time had come, that Downworld had to be ready to fight the Circle, Valentine unveiled his plan and armed his circle at the time when the accords of peace between Nephilim and Downworlders were to be signed again. His circle cut down Shadowhunters and Downworlders alike in the Great Hall of the Angel. Thanks to Lucian Greymark's warning, Downworlders were able to rush into the hall and surprise Valentine's circle. They'd been forewarned, and also heavily forearmed. The Shadowhunters surprised Magnus then, as the White Lords had surprised him before. The Clave did not abandon the Downworlders and turned to join with the circle. The vast majority of them, the Clave and the Institute leaders, made the choice the White Lords had made before them. They fought for their sworn allies and for peace, and Valentine's circle was defeated. But once the battle was done, the Shadowhunters blamed the Downworlders for the deaths of so many of their people, as if the battle had been Downworld's idea. The Shadowhunters prided themselves on their justice, but their justice for Magnus's kind was always bitter. Relations between the Nephilim and Downworld did not improve. Magnus despaired that they ever would. Especially when the Clave sent the last remaining members of the Circle, the Lightwoods, and another Circle member called Hodge Starkweather to Magnus's city to atone for their crimes by running the New York Institute as exiles from the Glass City. The Shadowhunters were scarce enough after the massacre and could not be replenished without the Mortal Cup, which seemed to have been lost with Valentine. The Lightwoods knew that they had been treated mercifully due to their high connections in the Clave, and that if they slipped up once, the Clave would crush them. Raphael Santiago of the Vampires, who owed Magnus a favor, or 20, reported that the Lightwoods were distant but scrupulously fair with every Downworlder they came into contact with. Magnus knew that sooner or later, he would have to work with them, would learn to be civil to them, but he preferred that it be later. The whole bloody tragedy of Valentine's Circle was over, and Magnus would rather not look back on the darkness, but look forward and hope for light. For more than 2 years after the uprising, Magnus didn't see any of Valentine's Circle again. Until he did. New York City, 1993. The life of warlocks was one of immortality, magic, glamour, and excitement through the ages. Sometimes, though, Magnus wanted to stay in and watch television on the sofa like everyone else. He was curled up on the sofa with Tessa, and they were watching a video of Pride and Prejudice. Tessa was complaining at some length about how the book was better.
"This is not what Jane Austen would have wanted," Tessa told him. "If she could see this, I'm certain she would be horrified."
Magnus uncurled from the sofa and went to stand by the window. He was expecting some Chinese to be delivered, and he was starving from a long day of idleness and debauchery. He did not see a delivery man, though. The only person on the street was a young woman carrying a baby wrapped up tight against the cold. She was walking fast, no doubt on her way home.
"If Jane Austen could see this," Magnus said, "I assume she'd be screaming there are tiny demons in this little box, fetch a clergyman, and hitting the television with her parasol."
The doorbell rang, and Magnus turned away from the window.
"Finally," Magnus said, grabbing a $10 bill from a table near the door, and he buzzed the delivery man in. "I need some beef and broccoli before I face any more Mr. Darcy. It's a truth universally acknowledged that if you watch too much television on an empty stomach, your head falls off."
"If your head fell off," Tessa said, "the hairdressing industry would go into an economic meltdown." Magnus nodded and touched his hair, which was now in a chin-length sweep. He opened the door, still in his pose, and found himself staring at a woman with a crown of red curls. She was holding a child. She was the woman he had seen on the street moments ago. Magnus was startled to see someone at his door who looked so mundane. The young woman was dressed in sloppy jeans and a tie-dyed t-shirt. She lowered her hand, which had been raised as if to knock on the door, and Magnus saw the flicker of faded, silvery scars on her arm. Magnus had seen far too many of those to ever be mistaken. She bore covenant marks, carried the remnants of old runes on her skin like mementos. She was not mundane in the least, then. She was a Shadowhunter. But a Shadowhunter bearing no fresh marks, not dressed in gear. She was not here on official Shadowhunter business. She was trouble.
"Who are you?" Magnus demanded.
She swallowed and replied,
I was Jocelyn Morgenstern."
The name conjured up memories years old. Magnus remembered the blade going into his back and the taste of blood. It made him want to spit. The monster's bride at his door. Magnus could not stop staring. She was staring too,
She seemed transfixed by his pajamas. Magnus was frankly offended. He'd not invited any wives of crazed hate cult leaders to come around and pass judgment on his wardrobe. If he wished to forego a shirt and wear scarlet drawstring pajamas patterned with black polar bears and a black silk bed jacket, he could do so. None of the others who had been lucky enough to see Magnus in his bedroom attire had ever complained.
"I don't remember ordering the bride of an evil maniac," said Magnus. "It was definitely beef and broccoli. What about you, Tessa? Did you order the bride of an evil maniac?"
He swung the door open wider so Tessa could see who was there. Nothing else was said for a moment. Then Magnus saw the blanket-covered lump in Jocelyn's arms stir. It was in that moment that he remembered there was a child.
"I've come here, Magnus Bane," Jocelyn said, "to beg your aid."
Magnus gripped the edge of the door until his knuckles went white.
"Let me think," he said. "No."
He was stopped by Tessa's voice, soft.
"Let her in, Magnus," she said.
Magnus wheeled around to look at Tessa.
"Seriously?"
"I want to speak with her."
Tessa's voice had taken on a strange tone. Also, the delivery person had just appeared in the hall carrying their bag of food. Magnus nodded Jocelyn inside, handed over the $10, and shut the door on the confused man's face before he had a chance to hand over the food. Now Jocelyn stood awkwardly by the door. The tiny person in her arms kicked its feet and stretched its legs.
"You have a baby," Magnus said, pointing out what was now obvious.
Jocelyn shifted uncomfortably and clutched the baby to her chest. Tessa padded toward them silently and stood by Jocelyn. Even though she wore black leggings and an oversized grey t-shirt that read, "William wants a doll," she still always carried an air of formality and authority about her. The shirt, as it happened, was a feminist statement that boys like to play with dolls and girls with trucks, but Magnus suspected she'd chosen it partly because of the name. Tessa's husband had been dead for long enough that his name brought back happy, faded memories instead of the raw agony she had felt for years after his passing. Other warlocks had loved and lost, but few were as hopelessly faithful as Tessa. Decades later, she had not allowed anyone else to even come close to winning her heart.
"Jocelyn Fairchild," Tessa said, "descended from Henry Branwell and Charlotte Fairchild."
Jocelyn blinked as if she'd not been expecting a lecture on her own genealogy.
"That's right," she said cautiously. "I know them, you see," Tessa explained. "You have a great look of Henry."
"Knew them?
Then you must be."
Henry had been dead for the better part of a century, and Tessa looked no older than 25.
"Are you a warlock too, then?" Jocelyn asked suspiciously.
Magnus saw her eyes drift from the top of Tessa's head to her feet, searching for a demon's mark, the sign that would indicate to Shadowhunters that she was unclean, inhuman, and to be despised. Some warlocks could hide their marks under their clothes, but Jocelyn could look at as much of Tessa as she wished and never find a mark. Tessa did not draw herself up obtrusively, but it was clear suddenly that Tessa was taller than Jocelyn was, and her grey eyes could be very cold.
"I am," said Tessa. "I am Teresa Grey, daughter of a greater demon and Elizabeth Grey, who was born Adele Starkweather, one of your kind. I was the wife of William Herondale, who was the head of the London Institute, and I was the mother of James and Lucy Herondale. Will and I raised our Shadowhunter children to protect mundanes, to live by the laws of Clave and Covenant, and to keep to the Accords."
She spoke in the way she well knew how, in the manner of the Nephilim.
"Once I lived among the Shadowhunters," Tessa said softly. "Once I might also have seemed like a person to you."
Jocelyn looked lost, in the way that people did when they learned something so strange that the whole world seemed unfamiliar.
"I understand if you find my crimes against Downworlders unforgivable," Jocelyn said, "but I have nowhere else to go, and I need help. My daughter needs your help. She is a Shadowhunter and Valentine's daughter. She cannot live among her own kind. We can never go back. I need a spell to shield her eyes from all but the mundane world. She can grow up safe and happy in the mundane world. She never needs to know what her father was." Jocelyn almost choked, but she lifted her chin and added, "or what her mother did."
"So you come begging to us," Magnus said, "the monsters."
"I have no quarrel with Downworlders," Jocelyn said at last. My best friend is a Downworlder, and I do not believe he is so changed from the person I always loved. I was wrong. I'll have to live forever with what I did. But please, my daughter did nothing.
Her best friend, the Downworlder. Magnus supposed that Lucian Greymark was still alive then, though nobody had seen him since the uprising. Magnus thought a little better of Jocelyn for claiming him as her best friend. People did say she and Lucian had planned to defeat Valentine together, though Jocelyn had not been there to confirm the rumor after the battle. Magnus had not seen Jocelyn during the uprising. He had not known whether to believe the claim or not. Magnus had often considered that Shadowhunter justice was more like cruelty, and he did not want to be cruel. He looked at the woman's weary, desperate face and the bundle in her arms, and he could not be cruel. He believed in redemption, the inchoate grace in every person he met. It was one of the few things he had to believe in, the possibility of beauty when faced with the reality of so much ugliness.
You said you were married to a Herondale.
Jocelyn appealed to Tessa, voice as faint as if she could already see the weakness of this argument, but she had none other to make.
Stephen Herondale was my friend.
Stephen Herondale would have killed me if he'd ever met me, said Tessa. I would not have been safe living among people like you or like him.
I am the wife and mother of warriors who fought and died and never dishonored themselves as you have.
I have worn gear, wielded blades, and slain demons, and all I wished was to overcome evil so that I could live and be happy with those I loved. I had hoped I'd made this a better, safer world for my children. Because of Valentine's Circle, the Herondale line, the line that was my son's children's children, is finished. That happened through you and your circle and your husband. Stephen Herondale died with hate in his heart and the blood of my people on his hands. I can imagine no more horrible way for mine and Will's line to end. I will have to carry for the rest of my life the wound of what Valentine's Circle has done to me, and I will live forever. Tessa paused and looked at Jocelyn's white, despairing face, and then said more gently, But Stephen Herondale made his own choices, and you've made other choices besides the one to hate. I know that Valentine could not have been defeated without your help, and your child has done no wrong to anybody.
That does not mean she has a right to our help, Magnus interrupted.
He didn't want to reject Jocelyn, but there was still a nagging voice inside him that told him she was an enemy.
Besides which, I'm not a Shadowhunter charity, and I doubt she has the money to pay for my help. Fugitives are so seldom well-funded.
I'll find the money, said Jocelyn. I'm not a charity case, and I'm not a Shadowhunter any longer. I want nothing more to do with the Shadowhunters. I want to be someone else. I want to raise my daughter to be someone else, not bound to the Clave or led astray by anybody. I want her to be braver than I was, stronger than I was, and to let nobody decide her fate but herself.
Nobody could ask for more than that for their child, Tessa said, and edged closer. May I hold her?
Jocelyn hesitated for a moment, holding the tightly wrapped bundle of the child close. Then slowly, reluctantly, her movements almost jerky, she leaned forward and placed her baby with enormous care into the arms of a woman she had just met.
She's beautiful, Tessa murmured.
Magnus did not know if Tessa had held a baby in decades. But she moved the child to her hip, held fast in the circle of her arm, with the instinctive, loving and casual air of a parent. Magnus had seen her once, holding one of her grandchildren, in just this way.
What's her name?
Clarissa, said Jocelyn, looking at Tessa intently, and then, as if she were telling them a secret, she said, I call her Clary.
Magnus looked over Tessa's shoulder and into the child's face. The girl was older than Magnus had thought. Small for her age, but her face had lost the roundness of babyhood. She must be almost two, and already looked like her mother. She looked like a fair child. She had red curls, the same color Henry's had been, clustering on her small head, and green eyes, glass clear and jewel bright, and blinking around curiously at her surroundings. She did not seem to object to being handed to a stranger. Tessa tucked the baby's blanket more securely around her, and Clary's small fists closed determinedly around Tessa's finger. The child waved Tessa's finger back and forth, as if to display her new possession. Tessa smiled down at the baby, a slow, bright smile, and whispered,
Hello, Clary.
It was clear that Tessa, at least, had made up her mind. Magnus leaned in, his shoulder resting lightly against Tessa's, and peered into the child's face. He waved to catch her attention, moving his fingers so all his rings sparkled in the light. Clary laughed, all pearly teeth and the purest joy, and Magnus felt the knot of resentment in his chest ease. Clary wriggled in a clear and imperious signal that she wanted to be let down, but Tessa handed her to Jocelyn so that Clary's mother could decide whether she should be put down or not. Jocelyn might not want her child roaming a warlock's home. Jocelyn did look around apprehensively, but either she decided it was safe or small, intently squirming Clary was stubborn and her mother knew she would have to let her go free. She put Clary down, and Clary went toddling determinedly off on her quest. They stood and watched her bright little head bob as she grabbed up, in turn, Tessa's book, one of Magnus's candles, which Clary chewed on thoughtfully for a moment, and a silver tray Magnus had left under the sofa.
"Curious little thing, isn't she?" Magnus asked.
Jocelyn glanced towards Magnus. Her eyes had been anxiously fastened on her child. Magnus found himself smiling at her.
"Not a bad quality," he assured her. "She could grow up to be an adventurer."
"I want her to grow up to be safe and happy," said Jocelyn. "I don't want her to have adventures. Adventures happen when life is cruel. I want her to have a mundane life, quiet and sweet. And I hope she would be born not able to see the shadow world. It is no world for a child. But I've never had much luck with hope. I saw her trying to play with a fairy in a hedge this afternoon. I need you to help me. I need you to help her. Can you blind her to all that?"
"Can I tear away an essential part of your child's nature and twist her into a shape that would suit you better?" Magnus asked her. "If you want her mad by the end of it."
He regretted the words as soon as he'd spoken. Jocelyn stared at him, white-faced as if she'd just been hit. But Jocelyn Morgenstern was not the kind of woman who wept, not the kind of woman who broke, or Valentine would have broken her long since. She held herself tall and asked, her voice level, "Is there anything else you can do?"
"There is something else I could try," said Magnus.
He did not say that he would. He kept his eyes on the little girl and thought of the young werewolf girl Valentine had blinded, of Edmund Herondale stripped of his marks centuries ago, and of Tessa's Jamie and Lucy and all they had borne. He would not give up a child to the shadow hunters, for whom the law came before mercy. Clary espied Magnus's poor cat. The great Catesby, who was getting on in years, lay prone upon a velvet cushion, his fluffy grey tail spilling over it. The adults all saw that disaster was imminent. They took a step forward as one, but Clary had already firmly pulled the great Catesby's tail with the regal assured air of a countess reaching for the bell pull to summon her maid. The great Catesby gave a piteous meow to protest the indignity, turned and scratched Clary, and Clary began to scream. Jocelyn was on her knees beside Clary the next instant, her red hair like a veil over her child, as if she could somehow screen Clary from all the world.
"Is she part banshee?" Magnus asked over the piercing wail.
Clary sounded like a police siren. Magnus felt as if he were going to be arrested for the 27th time. Jocelyn glared at him through her hair, and Magnus lifted his hands in mock surrender.
"Oh, pardon me for implying that the bloodlines of Valentine's child are anything less than pure."
"Come on, Magnus," Tessa said quietly. She had loved so many more shadow hunters than Magnus ever had. She went and stood beside Jocelyn. She put her hand against Jocelyn's shoulder, and Jocelyn did not shake her hand off.
"If you want the child safe," said Magnus, "she doesn't need only a spell to hide her own sight. She needs to be protected from the supernatural as well, from any demons who might come crawling to her."
"And what iron sister and silent brother will do that ceremony for me without turning Clary and me over to the Clave?" Jocelyn demanded. "No, I can't risk it. If she knows nothing of the shadow world, she will be safe." "My mother was a shadow hunter who knew nothing of the shadow world," said Tessa. "That didn't keep her safe."
Jocelyn stared at Tessa in open horror, obviously able to infer the story of what had happened, that a demon had gained access to an unprotected shadow hunter woman, and Tessa had been the result. There was a silence. Clary had turned curiously to Tessa as Tessa had approached, her screams forgotten. Now she lifted her chubby little arms out to Tessa. Jocelyn let Tessa take Clary again, and this time Clary did not try to wiggle away from her. Clary wiped her small, tear-stained face against Tessa's t-shirt. It seemed to be a gesture of affection.
Magnus hoped nobody would offer Clary to him in her current sticky condition. Jocelyn blinked and began, slowly, to smile. Magnus noticed for the first time that she was beautiful. Clary never goes to strangers. Maybe she can tell that you're not a stranger to the Fairchilds.
Tessa gazed at Jocelyn, her grey eyes clear. Magnus thought, in this case, Tessa was seeing more than he did.
Maybe. I will help you with the ceremony, she promised. I know a silent brother who will keep any secret if I ask him to.
Jocelyn bowed her head.
Thank you, Teresa Gray.
It occurred to Magnus how outraged Valentine would have been to see his wife beseeching Downworlders to think of his child in a warlock's arms. Magnus's thought of responding to Jocelyn's appeal with cruelty receded even further. This seemed the kind of revenge worth getting, to prove, even after Valentine's death, how wrong Valentine had been. He walked over to the two women and the child, and he glanced at Tessa, and he saw her nod.
Well then, Magnus said, seems we're going to help you, Jocelyn Morgenstern.
Jocelyn flinched. Don't call me that. I'm Jocelyn Fairchild.
I thought you weren't a shadow hunter anymore, Magnus said. If you don't want them to find you, changing your last name seems a fairly elementary first step. Trust me, I'm an expert. I've watched a lot of spy movies.
Jocelyn looked skeptical, and Magnus rolled his eyes.
I was also not born with the name Magnus Bane, he said. I came up with that one all on my own.
I actually was born Tessa Gray, Tessa said. But you should choose whatever name seems right to you. I've always said there is a great deal of power in words, and that means names too. A name you choose for yourself could tell you the story of what your destiny will be, and who you intend to become. Call me Frey. Let me join together the names of the Fairchilds, my lost family, and the Greys. Because you are a family friend, said Jocelyn, speaking with sudden firmness.
Tessa smiled at Jocelyn, looking surprised but pleased, and Jocelyn smiled down at her daughter. Magnus saw the determination in her face. Valentine had wanted to crush the world as Magnus knew it, but this woman had helped crush him instead, and now she was looking at her daughter as if she would make another world, shining and brand new just for Clary, so Clary would never be touched by any of the darkness of the past. Magnus knew what it was to want to forget as badly as Jocelyn did, knew the passionate urge to protect that came with love. Perhaps none of the children of the new generation, not this small, stubborn, red-headed scrap, or half-fairy Helen and Mark Blackthorne at the Los Angeles Institute, or even Maris Lightwood's children growing up in New York far from the Glass City, would ever have to learn the full truth about the ugliness of the past. Jocelyn stroked her little girl's face, and they all watched as the baby smiled, lit up with the sheer joy of living. She was a story in herself, sweet and full of hope, just beginning.
Jocelyn and Clary Frey, said Magnus. It's nice to meet you.
The Course of True Love and First Dates by Cassandra Clare. Read by Gareth David Lloyd.
It was Friday night in Brooklyn, and the city lights were reflecting off the sky. Orange-tinted clouds pressing summer heat against the sidewalks like a flower between the pages of a book. Magnus walked the floor of his loft apartment alone and wondered, with what amounted to only mild interest, if he was about to be stood up. Being asked out by a shadowhunter had been among the top 10 strangest and most unexpected things that had ever happened to Magnus. And Magnus had always endeavoured to live a very unexpected life. He had surprised himself by agreeing. This past Tuesday had been a dull day at home with the cat, and an inventory list that included horned toads. Then, Alec Lightwood, eldest son of the shadowhunters who ran the New York Institute, had turned up on Magnus's doorstep, thanked him for saving his life, and asked him out, while turning 15 shades between puce and mauve. In response, Magnus had promptly lost his mind, kissed him, and made a date for Friday. The whole thing had been extremely odd. For one thing, Alec had come and said thank you to Magnus for saving his life. Very few Shadowhunters would have thought of doing such a thing. They thought of magic as their right, due whenever they needed it, and regarded warlocks as either conveniences or nuisances. Most of the Nephilim would as soon have thought of thanking an elevator for arriving at the right floor. Then there was the fact that no Shadowhunter had ever asked Magnus out on a date before. They had wanted favors, of several kinds, magical and sexual, and strange. None of them had wanted to spend time with him, go out to a movie and share popcorn. He wasn't even sure Shadowhunters watched movies. It was such a simple thing. Such a straightforward request. As if no Shadowhunter had ever broken a plate because Magnus had touched it, or spat warlock as if it were a curse. As if all old wounds could be healed, made as though they had never been, and the world could become the way it looked through Alec Lightwood's clear blue eyes. At the time, Magnus had said yes because he wanted to say yes. It was quite possible, however, that he had said yes because he was an idiot. After all, Magnus had to keep reminding himself, Alec wasn't even all that into Magnus. He was simply responding to the only male attention he'd ever had. Alec was closeted, shy, obviously insecure, and obviously hung up on his blonde friend, Trace Wayland. Magnus was fairly certain that was the name. But Wayland had reminded Magnus, inexplicably, of Will Herondale, and Magnus didn't want to think about Will. He knew the best way to spare himself heartbreak was not to think about lost friends, and not to get mixed up with Shadowhunters again. He had told himself that this date would be a bit of excitement, an isolated incident, in a life that had become a little too routine, and nothing more. He tried not to think of the way he'd given Alec an out, and how Alec had looked at him, and said with devastating simplicity, "I like you." Magnus had always thought of himself as someone who could wrap words around people, trip them up, or pull the wool over their eyes when he had to. It was amazing how Alec could just cut through it all. It was more amazing that he didn't even seem to be trying. As soon as Alec had left, Magnus had called Katerina, sworn her to secrecy, and then told her all about it.
"Did you agree to go out with him because you think the Lightwoods are jerks and you want to show them you can corrupt their baby boy?" asked Katerina.
Magnus balanced his feet on Chairman Meow.
"I do think the Lightwoods are jerks," he admitted. "And that does sound like something I'd do, damn it."
"No, it doesn't really," said Katerina. "You're sarcastic 12 hours a day, but you're almost never spiteful. You have a good heart under all the glitter."
Katerina was the one with the good heart. Magnus knew exactly whose son he was and where he came from.
"Even if it was spite, no one could blame you, not after the circle, after all that happened."
Magnus looked out the window. There was a Polish restaurant across the street from his house, its flashing lights advertising 24-hour borscht and coffee, hopefully not mixed together. He thought of the way Alec's hands had trembled when he asked Magnus if he wanted to go out, and how glad and astounded he'd seemed when Magnus said yes.
"No," he said. "It's probably a bad idea. It's probably my worst idea this decade. But it had nothing to do with his parents at all. I said yes because of him."
Katerina was quiet for a few moments. If Ragnar was around, he would have laughed. But Ragnar had disappeared to a spa in Switzerland for a series of complicated facials, meant to bring out the green in his complexion. Katerina had the instinct of a healer. She knew when to be kind.
"Good luck on your date, then," she said.
"Much appreciated, but I don't need good luck. I need assistance," said Magnus. "Just because I'm going on this date does not mean it will go well. I am very charming, but it does take two to tango."
"Magnus, remember what happened the last time you tried to tango? Your shoe flew off and nearly killed someone."
"It was a metaphor. He's a shadow hunter. He's a Lightwood. He's in a bronze. He's a dating hazard. I need an escape strategy."
"If the date is a complete disaster, I'll text you. I'll say Blue Squirrel is his hot fox. Mission to be aborted with extreme prejudice. Then you call me and you tell me that there's a terrible emergency that requires my expert warlock assistance."
"This seems unnecessarily complicated."
"It's your phone, Magnus. There's no need for code names."
"Fine, I'll just text abort."
Magnus reached out and drew his fingers from Chairman Meow's head to his tail. Chairman Meow stretched and purred his enthusiastic approval of Magnus's taste in men.
"Will you help me?"
Katerina dragged in a long, annoyed breath. I will help you, she promised. But you've called in all your dating favors for this century, and you owe me. It's a bargain, said Magnus. And if it all works out, said Katerina, cackling, I want to be best woman at your wedding. I'm hanging up now, Magnus informed her. He had made a bargain with Katerina. He had done more than that. He had called and made reservations at a restaurant. He had selected a date outfit of red Ferragamo pants, matching shoes, and a black silk waistcoat that Magnus wore without a shirt because it did amazing things for his arms and shoulders. And it had all been for nothing. Alec was half an hour late. The probability was that Alec's nerve had broken, that he had weighed his life, complete with his precious Shadowhunter duty, against a date with a guy he didn't even like that much, and he was not coming at all. Magnus shrugged philosophically, and with a casualness he did not quite feel, padded over to his drinks cabinet, and made himself an exciting concoction, with unicorn tears, energizing potion, cranberry juice, and a twist of lime. He'd look back on this and laugh. One day. Probably tomorrow. Well, maybe the day after. Tomorrow he'd be hungover. He might have jumped when the buzzer sounded through the loft, but there was nobody but Chairman Meow there to see. Magnus was perfectly composed by the time Alec ran up the stairs and hurtled through the door. Alec could not have been described as perfectly composed. His black hair was going in every direction, like an octopus that had been dropped in soot. His chest was rising and falling hard under his pale blue t-shirt, and there was a light sheen of perspiration on his face. It took a lot to make Shadowhunter sweat. Magnus wondered exactly how fast he had been running. Well, this is unexpected, said Magnus, raising his eyebrows. Still holding his cat, he had flung himself lightly on the sofa. His legs hooked over one of the carved wooden arms. Chairman Meow was draped over his stomach, and meowing in perplexity about the sudden change in his situation. Magnus might have been trying a bit too hard to appear louche and unconcerned, but judging by Alec's crestfallen expression, he was really pulling it off. I'm sorry I'm late, Alec panted. Jace wanted to do some weapons training. I didn't know how to get away. I mean, I couldn't tell him. Oh, Jace, that's it, said Magnus. What? Said Alec. I briefly forgot the blonde one's name, Magnus explained with a dismissive flick of his fingers. Alec looked staggered. Oh, I'm Alec. Magnus's hand paused mid-dismissive flick. The gleam of city light through the window reflected off the blue jewels on his fingers, casting bright blue sparks that caught fire and then tumbled and drowned in the deep blue of Alec's eyes. Alec had made an effort, Magnus thought, though it took a trained eye to spot it. The light blue shirt fit him considerably better than the unholy grey sweatshirt that Alec had been wearing on Tuesday. He smelt vaguely of cologne. Magnus felt unexpectedly touched. Yes, said Magnus slowly, and then he smiled slowly as well. Your name, I remember. Alec smiled. Maybe it didn't matter if Alec did have a little thing for apparently Jace. Apparently Jace was beautiful. But he was the sort of person that knew it, and they were often more trouble than they were worth. If Jace was gold, catching the light and the attention, Alec was silver. So used to everyone else looking at Jace, that was where he looked too. So used to living in Jace's shadow, that he didn't expect to be seen. Maybe it was enough to be the first person to tell Alec that he was worth being seen ahead of anyone in a room, and of being looked at longest. And silver, though few people knew it, was a rarer metal than gold. Don't worry about it, said Magnus, swinging himself easily off the couch and pushing Chairman Meow gently under the sofa cushions, to the chairman's plaintively voiced dismay. Have a drink. He pushed his own drink hospitably into Alec's hand. He hadn't even taken a sip, and he could make himself a new one. Alec looked startled. He was obviously far more nervous than Magnus had thought, because he fumbled and then dropped the glass, spilling crimson liquid all over himself and the floor. There was a crash as the glass hit the wood and splintered. Alec looked like he had been shot, and was extremely embarrassed about it. Wow, said Magnus. Your people are really overselling your elite Nephilim reflexes. Oh, by the angel, I'm so sorry. Magnus shook his head and gestured, leaving a trail of blue sparks in the air, and the puddle of crimson liquid and broken glass vanished. Don't be sorry, he said. I'm a warlock. There's no mess I can't clean up. Why do you think I throw so many parties? Let me tell you, I wouldn't do it if I had to scrub toilets myself. Have you ever seen a vampire throw up? Nasty.
I don't really, know any vampires socially.
Alec's eyes were wide and horrified, as if he was picturing debauched vampires throwing up the blood of the innocent. Magnus was prepared to bet he didn't know any downworlders socially. The children of the angel kept to their own kind. Magnus wondered what exactly Alec was doing here in Magnus's apartment. He bet Alec was wondering the same thing. It might be a long night, but at least they could both be well-dressed. The t-shirt might show Alec was trying, but Magnus could do a lot better. I'll get you a new shirt, Magnus volunteered, and made his way to his bedroom while Alec was still faintly protesting. Magnus's closet took up half his bedroom. He kept meaning to enlarge it. There were a lot of clothes in it that Magnus thought would look excellent on Alec. But as he rifled through them, he realized that Alec might not appreciate Magnus imposing his unique fashion sense on him. He decided to go for a more sober selection and chose the black t-shirt that he'd been wearing on Tuesday. That was perhaps a little sentimental of Magnus. The shirt admittedly had "Blink if you want me" written on it in sequins, but that was about as sober as Magnus got. He tugged the shirt off its hanger and waltzed back into the main room to find that Alec had already taken his own shirt off and was standing around somewhat helplessly, his stained shirt clenched in his fist. Magnus stopped dead. The room was illuminated only by a reading lamp. All the other light came from outside the windows. Alec was painted with streetlights and moonlight, shadows curling around his biceps and the slender indentations of his collarbones, his torso all smooth, sleek, bare skin until the dark line of his jeans. There were runes on the flat planes of his stomach, and the silvery scars of old marks snaked around his ribs, with one on the ridge of his hip. His head was bowed, his hair black as ink, his luminously pale skin white as paper. He looked like a piece of art, chiaroscuro, beautifully and wonderfully made. Magnus had heard the story of how the Nephilim were created many times. They must have left out the bit that said, "And the angel descended from on high and gave his chosen ones fantastic abs." Alec looked up at Magnus, and his lips parted as if he was going to speak. He watched Magnus with wide eyes, wondering at being watched. Magnus exercised heroic self-control, smiled, and offered the shirt. "I'm sorry about being a lousy date," Alec muttered. "What are you talking about?" Magnus asked. "You're a fantastic date. You've only been here 10 minutes and already got half of your clothes off." Alec looked equal parts embarrassed and pleased. He told Magnus he was new to all this, so anything more than mild flirting might scare him off. Magnus had a very calm and normal date planned. No surprises, nothing unexpected. "Come on," said Magnus, and grabbed a red leather duster. "We're going to dinner." The first part of Magnus's plan, getting to the subway, had seemed so simple, so foolproof. It had not occurred to him that a Shadowhunter boy was not used to being visible and having to interact with the mundanes. The subway was crowded on a Friday night, which was not surprising, but did seem to be alarming to Alec. He was peering around at the mundanes, as if he had found himself in a jungle surrounded by menacing monkeys, and he was still looking traumatized by Magnus's shirt. "Can't I, use a glamour room?" he asked, as they boarded the F train. "No, I'm not looking like I'm alone on a Friday night just because you don't want mundanes staring at you." They were able to grab 2 seats, but it didn't appreciably improve the situation. They sat, awkwardly, side by side, other people's chatter rushing all around them. Alec was utterly silent. Magnus was fairly sure he wanted nothing more than to go home. There were purple and blue posters staring down at them, showing elderly couples looking sadly at one another. The posters bore the words, "With the passing years comes impotence." Magnus found himself staring at the posters with a sort of absent horror. He looked at Alec and found that Alec could not tear his eyes away either. He wondered if Alec was aware that Magnus was 300 years old and whether Alec was considering exactly how impotent one might become after that much time. 2 guys came onto the train at the next stop and cleared a space right in front of Magnus and Alec. One of them began to dance by swinging himself dramatically around the pole. The other sat cross-legged and started beating time on a drum he'd carried in with him. "Hello, ladies and gentlemen, whatever else you got," the dude with the drum called out.
We're going to perform for your entertainment. I hope you'll enjoy it. We call it the Butt Song.
Together, they began to rap. It was quite obviously a song they'd written themselves. Roses are red, they say love's not made to last, but I know I'll never get enough of that sweet, sweet ass. All that jelly in your jeans, all that junk in your trunk, I just gotta have it, one look, I was sunk. If you ever wonder why I had to make you mine, it's 'cause no other lady has a tush so fine. They say you're not a looker, but I don't mind, what I'm looking at is the view from behind. Never been romantic, don't know what love means, but I know I dig the way you're wearing those jeans. Hate to see you leave, but love to watch you go. Turn back, leave again, baby, do it slow. I'm coming right after, gonna make a pass. Can't get enough of that sweet, sweet ass. Most of the computers seemed stunned. Magnus was not sure if Alec was just stunned or if he was also deeply scandalized and privately commending his soul to God. He was wearing an extremely peculiar expression on his face, and his lips were very tightly shut. Under normal circumstances, Magnus would have laughed, and laughed, and given the buskers a lot of money. As it was, he was profoundly grateful when they reached their stop. He did fish out a few dollars for the singers, as he and Alec left the train. Magnus was reminded again of the extreme disadvantages to mundane visibility when a skinny, freckled guy slipped by them. Magnus was just thinking that he might have felt a hand snaking into his pocket when the guy gave a combination howl and screech. While Magnus had idly wondered if he was being pickpocketed, Alec had reacted like a trained shadow hunter. He grabbed the guy's arm and threw him up in the air. The thief flew, outstretched arms, limply wagging, like a cotton-stuffed doll. He landed with a crack on the platform, with Alec's boot on his throat. Another train rattled by, all lights and noise. The Friday night commuters ignored it, forming a knot of bodies, in tight, shiny clothes and artful hair, around Magnus and Alec. Alec's eyes were a little wide. Magnus suspected that he had been acting on reflex and had not actually intended to use force meant for demon foes against a mundane. The red-headed guy squawked, revealing braces, and flapped his hands in what seemed to be either urgent surrender or a very good panicked duck impression.
"Dude," he said, "I'm sorry, seriously, I didn't know you were a ninja, man."
Alec removed his boot and cast a hunted glance around at the fascinated stares of the bystanders. "I'm not a ninja," he muttered. A pretty girl with butterfly clips and her dreadlocks put a hand on his arm.
"You were amazing," she told him, her voice fluting. "You have the reflexes of a striking snake. You should be a stuntman. Really, with your cheekbones, you should be an actor. A lot of people are looking for someone as pretty as you who'd do his own stunts."
Alec threw Magnus a terrified and beseeching look. Magnus took pity on him, putting a hand on the small of Alec's back and leaning against him. His attitude and the glance he shot at the girl clearly communicated, "My date."
"No offense," said the girl, rapidly removing her hand so she could dig in a bag. "Let me give you my card. I work in a talent agency. You could be a star."
"He's foreign," Magnus told the girl. "He doesn't have a social security number. You can't hire him." The girl regarded Alec's bowed head wistfully.
"That's a shame. He could be huge. Those eyes."
"I realize he's a knockout," Magnus said, "but I'm afraid I have to whisk him away. He's wanted by Interpol." Alec shot him a strange look.
"Interpol?"
Magnus shrugged.
"Knockout?"
Alec said. Magnus raised an eyebrow at him.
"You had to know I thought so.
Why else would I agree to go on a date with you?" Apparently, Alec had not known for sure, even though he'd said Isabel and Jace had both commented on it. Maybe the vampires had all gone home and gossiped about the fact Magnus thought one of the Shadowhunters was a dreamboat. Magnus possibly needed to learn subtlety, and Alec possibly was not allowed access to mirrors at the Institute. He looked startled and pleased.
"I thought maybe, you know, you said you weren't unsympathetic."
"I don't do charity," said Magnus, "in any area of my life."
"I'll give the wallet back,"
piped up a helpful voice. The red-haired mugger interrupted what might have become a nice moment by scrambling to his feet, digging out Magnus's wallet and then dropping Magnus's wallet on the ground with a pained yelp.
"That wallet bit me!"
"That'll show you not to steal Warlock's wallets," Magnus thought, bending down to retrieve the wallet from a forest of sparkling high heels on the concrete. Aloud, he said, "This just isn't your lucky night, is it?"
"Your wallet bites people?" Alec asked.
"This one bites people," said Magnus, pocketing it. He was glad to have it back, not only because he liked money, but because the wallet matched his red crocodile skin pants.
The John Varvatos wallet burst into flames.
Who? Said Alec. Magnus gazed at Alec sadly.